All right, we apologize for getting started a little late. Welcome to session number 371, Levita Online. In this session, online writers will explore how much of their personal stories regarding such things as faith, doubt, disaffection, parenting, feminism, sexual identity, and politics they share on their blogs with friends and far-flung strangers alike. The questions we'll be talking about today are: how much information is too much to reveal? Where and how do online writers draw the line? And what are the rewards or potential drawbacks for being so publicly open? Let me do a couple of housekeeping things first. We'll be recording the session, so any question and answers would like you to come up to the microphone that will be set up at the end of when we're talking in the center. Each of the panelists will have about 15 minutes to talk about blogging from their own point of view. And before we get started, we'd like to ask you to silence all cell phones, noisemakers, incendiary devices so that we aren't unduly interrupted. And let me go ahead and introduce the panel to you. We had one of our panelists drop off. Helmut Lotz was not able to join us after all. But we have Heather Armstrong, the online writer at deuce.com. I pinched all of her bio information from her blog, so some of this will sound familiar. Heather is married to a charming geek named John, who's in the front row with us. They live in Salt Lake City with their 4-year-old daughter, Lita Elise, their 6-year-old super mutt, Chuck, and a 4-month-old miniature Australian shepherd named Coco. The chaos in their house is unreal. Heather's website chronicles her life from a time when she was single and making a lot of money as a web designer in Los Angeles, to when she was dating the man who would become her husband, to when she lost her job and lived life as an unemployed drunk, to when she married her husband and moved to Utah, and when she became pregnant, when she threw up and became unbearably swollen during the pregnancy, to the birth, the aftermath, and to the postpartum depression that landed her in a mental hospital. She says she's better now. And if you read her blog, you'll know all the details. Next in the lineup, we have Kaimi Wenger. He is an assistant professor of law at Thomas Jefferson Law School in San Diego, California. He's a graduate of Columbia University School of Law and was previously employed as a law clerk to District Judge Jack B. Weinstein of the Eastern District of New York and as a litigation associate at Kravath, Swain, and Moore in New York City. He is a founding member of the Mormon-themed weblog Times and Seasons at timesandseasons.org, and he comments freely on many, many LDS blogs. Our next panelist is Janet Gerard Willis. She's been reading Sunstone since a dazzling day of discovery in the honors reading room during her undergraduate days at BYU, during which she also made her first tentative forays into Sunstone symposium presentations. She holds a master's degree in literature from St. Louis University, where her PhD in 19th century American lit is forthcoming. She blogs for Feminist Mormon Housewives, and her personal essays and academic writing have appeared in the print medium here and there in as varied publications as Farms and Bust. Is that a magazine? Or?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know what kind, but anyway, that's a pretty good range. Let's see. Her print and academic writings have appeared in print here and there, not enough to please her dissertation committee, however. Currently, she and her husband and 1-year-old son, Finn, live in Salt Lake City and anxiously await the birth of their soon-to-be adopted daughter, expected in October. And our last panelist is Jana Bach-Remy. I have old information. I was supposed to interview her before this started. This is current as of 2006. She's pursuing a PhD in U.S. history, lives in Southern California with her husband John, children Christian and Emma, two cats, and 2,000 books. There might be more by now of the books. You can find her writing at Sunstone Blog, Exponent Blog, and at her solo blog, pilgrimgirl.blogspot.com. So without further ado, we'll have our panelists come up to the mic and talk about La Vida Online and get into some of the questions of how much you reveal on blogs and publicly about the information in your life. All right, go have it.
So I think, don't touch your quarter, I think I'm the resident hick of the panel. I only have an undergraduate degree that I got from BYU back in 1997. The month that the Rodin sculptures were banned. I don't know if any of you guys remember that. I was part of the protest, and then there was the protest that was protesting the protest. And that was the beginning of the end for me, you could say, in terms of my religious faith. But I blog at a place called deuce.com, and I started it back in 2001 just as a place to talk about pop culture and music, and I was dating soap stars, and I knew how to make a web page, and I thought, I want to make my own online space. This is, I feel like I'm going to, like...
Do like on stage.
There you go. Okay. So, let's see. I sent out an email to about 34 of my friends and said, "Hey guys, I know you guys all live across the country. Come see me in my blog." And this is when, in 2001, when if you told someone you had a blog, they thought it, you meant you had a venereal disease. And I would always say yes, and it hurts, and it's contagious. Within a year, I had sort of switched jobs and worked at a software company and hated my job. And my boss was this typical Hollywood, how do I say this? She would come into the office and you could see where she had injected Botox into her lips. And you could see the prick marks, and she begged it to be written about. And she would order Prada purses online and talk about it out loud and drop names about who she knew in the industry, and she was related to so-and-so, and I thought it would be fun to make fun of her and make fun of a lot of the other people that I worked with, and I was really naive at the time, thinking, oh, no one's going to find this. This is a blog. No one reads blogs. And then an anonymous person sent an email to every vice president of the company, and within a few minutes, you could hear some cackling going on in all the offices. And one of the guys came out and said, "Dude, you were right on about her. You know, like, what, dude?" And then she found it. And that was one of the most harrowing days of my life, sort of being confronted with humiliating a person in public and having her sit across from me going, "Why would you do this to me?" And they fired me immediately. I was fired. I was walked to my car with a cardboard box full of everything and told to leave and never come back. And it was one of the first times that this had happened to anybody online, losing your job or getting in trouble because of something you've written on your website. And here I was faced with what I had become as a human being. I mean, here I had humiliated someone, lost my job because of it, and I just didn't know who I was and what did this say about me. And I had grown up being I was Laurel president. I, you know, had perfect attendance at early morning seminary in Memphis, Tennessee. I was a valedictorian. I graduated BYU with honors. And here I was fired for something stupid thing I had written on my website. So I took it down for 6 months because I didn't want to have a midlife crisis for the world to see online. In that 6 months, I met John, and oddly, we sort of bonded. I don't even know if I can talk about this here. We sort of bonded because he sent me the link to exmormons.org, and we sort of shared an experience of being disillusioned with our faith and what it meant and how we were brought up and where we wanted to go. Now, this whole time, my parents had known about my website and whatnot, and I believe it was... 2 days after September 11th, after, you know, September 11th was hard for everyone. It was a big identity crisis for everyone. And I sat down at my computer, had a couple martinis, and then wrote this horrible, horrible diatribe about how Mormons were no better than fundamentalist Islamists, which I'm not proud of it. It was horrible, and my parents found my website that day. Now, I think that they had had an idea that maybe I wasn't going to church anymore, but then all of a sudden they were confronted with page after page after page of me talking about having sex with strangers and getting drunk and being hungover at work and how I thought that Mormons were going to blow up buildings. My family didn't, well, certain members of my family didn't speak to me for several months, and I had another personal crisis. Holy hell, how long does it take me to learn my lesson? There are certain things you can say publicly, and there are certain things you shouldn't say publicly. Since then, my boundaries have gotten, you know, much, much bigger, and I'm very, very careful about what I write on my website. And interestingly, my family, we've moved back to Utah, I've had a child. My family and I are closer because of my website, and I think my mom routinely gives talks at church about how to remain friends with the child that has gone astray. And they all go, I think I know who your daughter is. They have come to accept, and I have come to accept, I let them be who they are, they let me be who I am, and I think that my blog of anything, this little venereal disease blog, has brought my family through something that could have potentially torn us apart for the rest of our lives. And what I tell, when I tell anybody that wants to start a website, my thing, what I say to them is always go into it wanting people to be excited to see themselves on what in what you're writing. And I never want someone to be disappointed that I said something about them. I want them to go, oh, she wrote about me today. That is the main boundary that I go into this with. My husband is basically the person who taught me all of this. I mean, I've learned this from the experience, but knowing that he's the one that's going to be reading it, he's a part of my life. I write about my life every day. And for me, it's been this huge 8.5-year journey. And it now supports my family, and we do this for a living. And I actually love the size of this audience. It's really intimate. Last week, I spoke to an audience of about 1,500 women who wanted to slice my neck off. And this is just a really refreshing change. But that's my story. Thank you.
So I really appreciate Heather's comments, because I think I'm going to be trying to build on or just copy off of or piggyback on a little bit of those themes. I'm totally going to steal your themes, but that's okay, because I think everybody's going to, because they're similar themes. Blogging is, it's an interesting environment. I mean, I started about 2008, 5 years ago, a couple of friends and I were on an email listserv, and we were hashing out these issues, and we were talking about, you know, church doctrine and same-sex marriage and abortion and feminism and same-sex marriage and abortion and church history and same-sex marriage and abortion. And after a while, we said, wait a minute, we should start blogging about this. And at the time, I had a blog, Nate had a blog, a couple of us had personal blogs, and we were blogging about politics or whatever else, same-sex marriage, abortion. But we figured maybe we should just do this in a group. And so with some of these characters, I started a blog called Times and Seasons, and then a few months later a blog called By Common Consent. And then we decided we needed a name for this. And so I posted a post saying, because I learned that the Jewish blogs have this cool name, J-Blog, and the Catholic blogs have this cool name, St. Blogs Parish, I mean, which is a great name. So I posted a post, and I said, what's our name? And the best we could come up with was Bloggernacle, which is a distant third to the other two, I think. But it did give us a sense of identity. And so we started the blog vernacle, and a whole bunch. I mean, there's a whole bunch of characters in the audience here who are now on board. I mean, so it became this great community. It started out with, you know, just a couple of us. You know, wow, we got 20 readers. Wow, we got 40. Wow, we have 500 readers. And now it becomes this great community. In the process, we went through a whole bunch of these sorts of questions. What are we going to talk about? How much are we going to talk about? One of my first posts was, "Do you have a duty to stick with the dysfunctional ward?" That's kind of an interesting thing to talk about, because, you know, is anyone in my ward going to read this? I mean, fortunately, my ward was sufficiently dysfunctional that I don't think anyone was reading the blogs. But but that raises questions. What happens if somebody does read a blog, and how much can I talk about myself, about these questions that I have online? There are a lot of benefits to it. I mean, the reasons we started, we can have these great discussions. I mean, you can't have discussions with your friends at Sunday school about, well, does medicinal marijuana come within the NyQuil exception to the Word of Wisdom? Like, you really can't. But it's a great topic to think about on a blog. Like, well, if you can drink NyQuil, which is like 40% alcohol, for medicinal purposes, then what about marijuana? So, you know, kicking around interesting ideas, it gave this great forum to do that. Plus, it turns out, like, you can meet friends, and it creates this great sort of pastoral effect where people can talk to you. And we realized this the first time when one person, I think it was driven home for me the first time when one person posted a post saying, "Please pray for my son. He's in the hospital. He was just in a swimming pool accident, and they're not sure if he's going to live." And it was this very deeply intimate, heartfelt post, and everybody on the blog vernacle was praying for his little boy, and then his little boy came through, and it was just this great experience. And we realized that this is like an online ward, sort of, and a little bit like a ward. But what do we do with this? Because we don't see each other. I mean, if I look at, you know, I can see Mary Ellen or Jenna, I can talk to them, but we don't do this online, and so we have to do it under online identities. So it turns out that there's a whole lot of effort and thought that goes into what do I do to create this online identity, and what boundaries do I set? A lot of the same questions which Heather just talked about, and which I suspect everybody's going to be, because it seems like there's a couple of paradoxes that we deal with. On the one hand, an online community is most effective at helping us as people, at helping us in our lives when we can be honest and open. But then being honest and open in an online community can also have negative repercussions and fallout in our everyday lives. So how do we try to balance those two? And then the second paradox is that for many Mormons, I think compartmentalization becomes a way to try to deal with this. And you have your work self and your church self and your friend self or whatever else, and you don't necessarily merge these as much. And online, working or discussing in an online community can become a way to compartmentalize and say, okay, I can talk online, you know, with Nate Oman about church history and then go to Sunday school and not worry about that stuff and just, you know, nod and smile. But then online identities themselves they can sometimes make compartmentalization complicated, because your ward members might find your blog, and then all of a sudden down come all the compartmentalization walls, and everybody's like, wow, what are you writing about? So we get these interesting paradoxes. I do think that these communities can be really helpful when we can be open and honest and discuss things. One theme that I see again and again, and people say, I can't talk about this in Sunday school. And it's not all wacky themes, but it's interesting. You know, people say, I've never heard about these changes in the Word of Wisdom over history. And, you know, how do you deal with that? And, you know, whether some people leave the church because of it, some people don't, you know, I think it's entirely possible to be a believing church member and know history of Word of Wisdom. I mean, and many people do. Where's Kevin Barney? And Kevin's in the audience. Yep. And Kevin Barney, you know, and others write about this, that it's totally possible to do this, but it's not the sort of thing that many people discuss in Sunday school, so it can be a great way to say, I've got these questions, I don't understand these things, and people have written and said, you know, your blog kept me in the church, which is really, and then other people write and say, your blog drove me from the church, which is, I guess, you know, maybe we're doing a little bit of both. So we can be most effective when we've got openness. It allows us to communicate with other people. It allows us to have these conversations and connections. It allows us to vent, which is sometimes necessary. It allows you to feel like you're not alone. And yet there's real risk, because what happens if somebody in the ward reads it and freaks out and says, wow, this person's talking about these church history issues. They're talking about polygamy. They're talking about whatever. At least one person has been subjected to church discipline for their blog. Other people have been called in for questions, no actual discipline, but called in for questions about their blogs. It's not always, as a church member, it's not always viewed as proper to say things. And so if I have a question about church history, and if I say, I don't understand, I don't understand polyandry, I have huge concerns with this, and I say it on a blog, is this going to concern my bishop? Is this going to result in a sort of top-down discipline, September 6th? Is it going to result in local repercussions? Is it going to result in my mom reading the blog and freaking out? So you get all of these interesting questions. You know, I want to be honest on the one hand and open because that allows me to have these conversations that I can't have in other forums. But on the other hand, blogs are not a gated community. It's not me and Mary Ellen and Janet just sitting there, the three of us talking, because all sorts of people can come by and read this. And that's the double-edged sword, because it's both good and bad. I mean, it's good because you get people coming by. You get Bart and Vernal coming by for the first time and saying, wow, people are talking about these topics. You get Jessowai coming by, wow, people are talking about this. This is great. I had no idea people were talking about this. But then you get people who might feel threatened by these discussions coming in and seeing them as negative, and then what sort of fallout is going to come out of that? So we get this difficult sort of Hobson's choice. You know, do you expose yourself, your beliefs, your doubts, your questions, and get the benefit from it, but face the potential risks or fallout? Or do you just blog as a very closed cipher? I'm not going to talk about this. Or you can hide behind certain shields. You can be anonymous, or you can be pseudonymous. You can be the pseudonymous, Bord and Vernal, or Kiskelily, pseudonymous. Nobody knows who these people really are in real life. But then, does that limit your ability of real-life friends, ward members, to perhaps bond and relate and say, wow, I know that person. It's great that that person thinks this. And, of course, if you're completely anonymous and you just post everything anonymously, then it's really impossible to trace anything. But that limits our ability to get to know you, to sympathize with you, to feel like you're one of us in a community. And pseudonymity isn't perfect either, because I actually know of multiple instances where people, I don't know, vigilantes might be the right, online sleuth wannabes try to unmask these people and say, who is this person? Because I want to tell them that they're wrong. Or, I want to, there's the great comment from the Women Who Know session, be glad I'm not your ecclesiastical leader. Just really threatening sorts of reactions sometimes. So we're stuck with that choice. And then the second choice is how to figure out how to compartmentalize this, right? Because we do everybody compartmentalizes. You have your conversations, you have your work conversation at work, you have your home conversation at home, you have your conversation about how much you, your conversation about how silly you think Jana is when Jana's not around. It's compartmentalization, it works. And we do this, and actually we get a lot of this online, and people say, I can have this conversation that I can't have around my work members, and it's so wonderful that I can do this. But then it turns out that it becomes harder to compartmentalize now, because we're entering into the sort of Web 2.0 world, and everybody's getting on the internet. I mean, you roll back the clock 5 years ago, and you could have an online community, and your grandmother and your work members were unlikely to ever see it, because, I mean, who's heard of a blog? I mean, they think it's a venereal disease. They're going to stay away from it. But nowadays, everybody has a blog. Everybody's on Facebook. I mean, so all of a sudden, it's harder to keep these compartmentalization chambers separate. I mean, what are we going to do? You sign up for Facebook and they say, what's your religion? And that's a loaded question. Okay, do I want to put that I'm Mormon? Do my work colleagues know that I'm Mormon? Am I okay with that? All right, but maybe I don't want my work colleagues to know that I'm Mormon, or maybe I want to put a disclaimer on there so that they don't think that I hate gay people. So maybe I'll put liberal Mormon. But my ward members are on Facebook, too, and do I want my ward members to know that I'm... And my mom's on... Well, my mom's not, thank goodness, but, some people's moms are on Facebook, and, do you want her to know that you're... Or do you want to put something funny and try to be goofy, like, I'm a Wiccan, Mormon, Pastafarian, Unitarian, and make it into a big joke so everybody thinks it's funny? Or would they just get weird? Yeah, so you get these interesting questions. I mean, how do you put... I'm Christian LDS. People put Christian LDS. So you get these... When the categories start to collapse, and all of a sudden your ward members, your work colleagues, your family members might see you in the same arena, it becomes difficult to keep up the compartmentalization walls. I know people who have multiple Facebook accounts, and one that they show to one group and one that they show to another group. That sounds like a lot of work, and I'm fundamentally lazy, so I don't do that. It becomes a difficult question, how to keep these compartmentalization areas separate. And then you get the question of authenticity, right? Because on the one hand, you get people saying, on blogs, I can be myself. And this is me. This is the real me. I have to not talk about who I really am in Sunday school because everybody just agrees on, you know, wacky principles, and everybody just quotes from, you know, first edition Mormon doctrine, and I just have to nod and grit my teeth. And then I can come on Feminist Mormon Housewives and vent, vent, vent. But there's also the real possibility of inauthenticity online. I mean, you're just a bunch of dots on a screen. And so if I'm looking at people, I'm looking at Mike, and I go, okay, that's really Mike. I know that he really exists. You've got, there are blog characters that don't even really exist. And there's been a few of those have wandered through the blogger knackle from time to time. Characters who create a life story but then turn out to be fictitious, and this creates interesting questions. I mean, is it really more authentic to be online? Is it less authentic? Is it just a mixture of authenticity and inauthenticity? And how do we try to balance that? I mean, am I really being myself when I'm online, or am I just being somebody slightly different than I am in other contexts? And this, it gets particularly highlighted because there's this perception of privacy in a lot of online spheres that aren't really private. So if I've got a simple blog, it's just me and I email it to a couple of friends, I may think that I'm in a safe space and I can talk about issues. I mean, I'm just in a room with three people and we're discussing these things, and yet the internet is not actually private. Just because you think you've got the privacy of a dark corner and nobody's looking and you're just having a conversation with your three friends in the corner doesn't mean that they can't suddenly shine a spotlight on it and everybody sees the conversation. And this has blown up in numerous instances. I mean, most famously recently, with a federal judge who had a website which he thought was private where he posted a bunch of raunchy humor pictures. And it turned out that it wasn't private. It was something which other people were able to access. He removed himself from he was ironically overseeing an obscenity case at the time, removed himself from the case, and there was a big scandal over it. But this happens repeatedly. People say, I have to guard myself because this isn't really a private place, and then you get this chilling effect. How much can I really talk? And then that feeds back to the first question, which is, well, if I can't talk that much and I can't share this much about myself, then how useful can the community really be? There aren't really answers to... One final element that comes up is that there are really nasty, evil people out there who actually are not just necessarily well-intentioned, if slightly misguided, parents, church leaders, whoever, who are shocked, but who actually make sport out of making fun of other people online, threatening other people online. And there's some really nasty characters. There's this great article on the New York Times just a week ago about people who make sport out of ridiculing other people who have just had deaths in the family and posting their phone numbers online and trying to get people to order pizza for them. You go back a couple of months and there's the Kathy Sierra case where this woman is getting rape threats and death threats online on her blog because a bunch of people thought that would be fun, I guess. Really twisted reactions. And we've got a few pretty twisted antisocial psychopaths in the blogger angle too, it seems. So what do you do? I mean, you want to have a conversation that's open and honest because you want to be able to talk about these religious issues, personal issues, spirituality issues that are important to you, connect with other people, get support, and yet you're worried that your mom's going to read it, you're worried that some psychopath's going to come along and make death threats, you're worried that your boss might read it. Ultimately, from what I've found, it's a balancing act. We all have to figure out what the right balance is for us. I know some people who continue to remain pseudonymous and may be pseudonymous for the rest of their blogging careers. I've been onymous. That's actually the opposite. It's a word that gets seldom used, but onymous for my blogging career, and that has its drawbacks too. And my work colleagues can Google me, and sometimes I say that's negative because my work colleague might be Googling me as I'm asking some weird question, and they're like, "Wow, that's some weird Mormon stuff. What are you doing?" But it is an interesting way to sort of to try to blend the two aspects of our lives. It does, I think, keep you from being completely different. You can't be an anti-Mormon and a Mormon or an anti-Catholic and Catholic, but you can be different facets and you can see those different facets. And that's not a bad thing. And I guess it is something that we all have to figure out which of our facets we're going to allow to show online. There's no silver bullet. There's no magical answer. But to the extent that we're aware of it, I think if we've got the courage, the ability, the safety to blog as honestly as we can, that there are real benefits from that. And hopefully, there's this great New York Magazine article from about 3 or 4 years ago where he says, everybody's online now, everybody has a blog, everybody's got Flickr pictures, so it should just not matter. I don't think we've arrived at that world yet, but as more and more people enter into the blogging world, we may get to that space at some point where everybody's got their doubts, everybody's got their random conversations online, and then maybe it won't matter, and that'll be a place where we can really start to benefit from these conversations in a way that will be open and honest and without fear. And hopefully that's some place where we'll be soon. Thanks.
So I am not like Heather or Kayume. I am not a pioneer. That should be a primary song. Not a pioneer. I'm actually something of a Luddite, which is, I suppose, an oddity for someone who is a blogger. I am not particularly good with technology, and thus I had the fun, there's an adjective for you, experience of entering the Bloggernacle as with a great deal of naivete intact. I wasn't quite aware of the degree to which realities would start to overlap. In fact, I started commenting under the belief, violating my feminist belief, that the personal is always the political, that I could have this space where I would be able to discuss church theology dispassionately with intellect, and I could get my intellectual stimulation because I am a stay-at-home mom, and as much as I love my son, you know, he doesn't really want to talk about literary theory with me. And then I could go to church and talk about church, and then, you know, I could compartmentalize. Like Kayume, that lasted all of 5 seconds. Those of you in the audience who know me well would know why. I am not good at segregating the different portions of my personality. The personal entered the political, if you can call the blogosphere that, very rapidly. And that became a very complicated and remains a complicated experience for me. But I think the central question behind both of the presentations preceding mine and what I want to speak about as well involves the question of what is community anyway? We're kind of assuming that there's some prima facie definition out there that we're tapping into, but I don't think that that's true. And part of the angst we experience regarding blogs has to do with the fact that we're not sure how to define community, nor are we sure if we can belong to one community that seems at odds with another community and remain faithful to both. I would say that you can, but it's very tricky. Also, I talk way too fast because I'm from the West Coast. Sorry. I was recently reading an essay by Wendell Berry, another Luddite who I love, and he was defending his refusal to get a computer to write on, asking the question, why in the world should I improve something which is perfectly adequate how it is? Why would I want a computer when I can take the back of my envelope and my pen out into the woods and be like Thoreau and have everything with me that I need instead of all the accoutrements necessary for a computer? And that's a fine question, really, to ask. Does the community that we already have without blogs need improvement? Does the blogging community need improvement? And will blogging help or hurt the communities we had before we started to blog? I have to ask myself what my personal investment in those questions are, because sort of my central concern in my life is community. I'm obsessed with it. So to answer that question, will blogging improve community? I think it's pretty obvious that the answer has to be both yes and no. There's sort of, for the sake of time, two models I want to talk about. Blogging in the Bloggernacle, the particularly Mormon corner of the internet, it can function the way I hope that it functions. And I spoke about this in the lovely women's issue of Sunstone, where for some reason they elected to interview me. And I'm just going to read the paragraph where I shared my little idealistic diatribe. We at Feminist Mormon Housewives get emails and comments, not infrequently, from people just thanking us and saying, I never knew there was a place where I could safely talk about my doubts without having people assume that my doubts negate what I believe or what I hope to believe. And the more open they can become, even if it's anonymously online, the more open they'll be able to become in their wards. And the more open a ward becomes, the more you get true communitas, the more you really get the gospel of Jesus Christ, the more you get people who love each other genuinely rather than for some falsified image. And that is my kind of revolution. I stand by those statements. That is my kind of revolution, and it is a possibility inherent in expanding our definition of community. I kind of would call that the ripple effect. If you make a tentative foray anonymously online, slowly you come out of your shell a little more, and then people know your pseudonym, so that becomes a doppelganger for who you really are, and then your doppelganger and your real self kind of converge, and then you can just be who you are at church, and then everybody will love everyone for who they are, and la la la. We will all go to heaven. Yeah, I'm a big hippie, and I believe that. But that's not the only possibility. The other possibility is that the compartmentalization, which Kaimi spoke to so well, can start to become a little bit insidious. Some of you might be familiar with a theorist named Foucault. In addition to my hippie self, I also have my unwritten dissertation, literary theory reading self, and so I read a lot of this guy. And he talks about how power structures are often maintained by offering the people in lower positions in hierarchy sort of a place to vent so they can blow off steam, and they think they have power because, look, they blew off some steam. And then because the steam is gone, the tea kettle stops screaming and the water stays pretty hot, but it stays on the stove. And that can happen with online communities as well. If they only become places to vent, then instead of becoming increasingly more and more open and more authentic, if you will, with the flesh and blood people we encounter in our lives as well as the people we encounter through ones and zeros on the computer, that has the possibility for not just compartmentalization, but fragmentation and downright dishonesty, where we refuse to really encounter our cognitive dissonance because our doppelgangers become almost independent of each other. I have my internet self, I have my church self, they don't talk to each other, and I'll go to church and I'll lie about who I am, but because I do go to church and that is really part of who I am, if I'm pretending it isn't online, that's a lie too. Two lies don't really work well together. So Foucault provides me with a little of caution. We have the teapot effect as well as the ripple effect. We can become more alienated from each other just as we can become more honest with each other. And naturally, both of those happen all the time, interchangeably, and anyone who realizes it has to decide how they're going to engage that space and maintain their personal integrity. And I would never argue that the answer to that question needs to be the same for different people. I can only speak to my own experience. Another phrase I tend to overuse is liminal space. John Remy can laugh now at me. Online spaces are liminal. We have to decide what we do when we exit them. My personal choice is to enter and exit the Blabbernacle, ideally the same way I enter and exit every other communal space in my life. I've chosen, like Kaimi and Heather, to be honest about my legal name, my identity. But that comes with risks, which she's also spoken of. I remember the few days after my picture appeared in the Salt Lake Tribune, holding my baby above my head, and then there was next to the picture of me tossing my kid up in the air. There was something about feminist and faithful, and it was almost like the competing realities we talk about with your church self and your online self. Don't talk about doubts, talk about doubts. Good little Mormon woman, look, she has a baby. Oh, look, she can be a feminist. And the picture in the paper was almost in dialogue, but I was surprised a little bit by the number of people who talked to me about that, who were surprised that I would be a feminist, because I thought, my heavens, I'm increasingly open about that at church. I've never not asked a question. I've never shut up. I'm sure my bishops for the years really wished I would have, on occasion, shut up. But that openness about my identity online and in my words has exacted a price. Not as dramatic one as Heather. Nobody ever marched me to my car with a cardboard box. But there are, you know, there are people at church who treat me like I'm slightly kooky or maybe volatile or maybe more contagious, like the blog is a venereal disease. We're not sure we want any of your intellectualism here. We know you seem nice. But there's also a risk Particularly if you're a permablogger for a blog or someone who writes regularly and not just a commenter, in being extremely open about your emotions and not just your thoughts, and making it clear that emotions and thoughts indeed can't be divorced from each other. And that is that you are sharing yourself with others, but inevitably, and this is a good thing, but inevitably people will share back. And that means a great deal to me. I've made many friends online, deep, close friends, a lot of whom are sitting here. But, sometimes the human brain has a threshold of other people's trauma it can contain. And those of you who are familiar with my blog, Feminist Mormon Housewives, will know that currently I'm on a sabbatical for two reasons. Unfinished dissertation, angry committee, to illness. The illness is part long-ranging, but it was exacerbated in part by the fact that I received hundreds of emails from people spilling their stories of trauma with me and begging me to help them. And I want to help them. I believe in community. Oh, Jesus, like testimony meeting. I believe in using whatever space I'm given to build bridges between my heart and the hearts of others, but bridges can't bear any weight. And in a natural, there's an artificial term for you, right there, natural. In a community that's bounded by geography, you're only going to know a certain number of people. You're only going to have a certain amount of crises you have to withstand at one given point in time. That is not true on the internet. You can get 200 emails in one day from people begging you to tell them how to make it through another hour. And that can be very, very hard. So the question that I'm currently engaged in as a blogger and as a human being is, how do I maintain enough personal strength to help those people without cutting myself off from them so I'm not even there to ask help from in the first place? And I do not have an answer to that question. I hope I do at some point. Maybe, like most portions of identity, we figure out the answer only by enacting it, trial and error. But we are at the peril of having the gift that we offer others turned into a tool for the sublimation of their demons. We are also at the peril of having the gift return. And for a lot of us, that is just as scary as being used deleteriously. I'm grateful that people seem to connect with me. It means a great deal to me. But I don't know how to use that the best way to help me and to help others. And instead of trying to answer that question, I'm just going to leave it with the question. I do not know where we draw the line and still maintain our own strength. Thank you.
With two caveats. The first one being that usually when I'm at Sunstone, I stand proudly at the lectern and give my talks, but today I'm feeling incredibly fragile. And for those of you who do follow my blog, know last week I just had surgery after ongoing long illness. And really glad to be here today, and I'm not weepy, and I'm not weak, but I am today. Typically, I'm not. So if you can just bear with me, I appreciate it. And then the second little thing is I prepared something to read, so I'm not going to speak as extemporaneously as the previous panelists have, is that as I'm reading, one of the interesting things about my life right now online is that I have teenage children who now have online lives and have feelings about how they're portrayed in public space. So I'm going to be using their chosen online identities. My 14-year-old son goes by Game Boy, and my 11-year-old daughter has multiple online personas, but I call her Cat Girl on my blog, so that's what we're going to use today. So as I speak about them, as I'm reading, that's just so you know who I'm talking about. Okay. Oh, the other thing I wanted to say, okay, I'm just going to have one more caveat. I can do that, I guess. My talk is kind of introspective and somber, and I think that's just where I'm at right now, but I wanted to start, just for those of you who aren't familiar with my blog, with something that's not so introspective and self-indulgent and somber, so you know I'm not always like that. And so this is a little brief post from my blog. It's called Short Shameful Confession Number 4. And I have a series of these short shameful confessions. I can't even speak my words. It's crazy. Okay. So this is number 4. I was thinking that my neighbors had been cooking something particularly stinky for dinner tonight, and I was getting rather annoyed by the strength of the smell. Now, I live in an apartment building, so my neighbors are a big part of my life. Okay, until I realized that this comforting stench was actually a piece of salmon that had fallen in my cleavage while I was eating my own dinner. So that's my funny thing I'm going to start with, and now I go into my self-indulgent, somber, woe is me talk. All right. I have a ritual for my twice daily wound dressings. It involves the expected hand washing, opening of sterile wrappers, cleaning and laying out of tweezers and scissors, and dousing of the affected area with saline. Then I start to breathe. In my yoga practice, my teacher taught us to send energy through our bodies by imagining a furnace sitting at the base of our spine. With each breath in, we stoke the fire of that engine, make it burn hotter and brighter, and as it enlarges the energy, and the warmth shoots down our fingers, our legs and arms, creating arcs of energy that radiate out of our finger and toe tips. While I'm doing a dressing change and I breathe in and out, I imagine a pinwheel of fire in my belly that sends light to my leg. The light warms and soothes the tissue, preparing for the moment when I have to grab the tip of the gauze that's packed into the wound and pull. The gauze doesn't come easily. It's packed in with pressure and cemented by blood and slugs of new tissue. And that's exactly the point. The pull debrides the wound, cleans it, keeps it open. For me, it's a horror to hurt myself that way, to rip open a sore that is doing its best to heal closed. To tug at the tissue that is so raw and tender for months of inflammation feels counterintuitive for my deepest fiber. I find it's only when I breathe my special yoga way that I can make my hand do what has to be done. As I performed my ritual recently, my mind stuck for a moment on how this has to be done. In my case, it has to be done in order for my surgery to be effective. But I let that thought expand as I thought of other times in my life that I'm doing what has to be done. I thought of my life as a leg amputee. How much of that is simply finding ways of doing what has to be done? Walking with a prosthesis, ignoring the stares of passersby, standing unselfconsciously in front of a classroom. Not easy things, but to me they are not courageous, heroic, or unusual. They're a means to an end. I have little choice in the matter. Like the gauze that must be pulled, I cannot change my physical difference. It is what has to be done for me to move through daily life. And of course, we all have to do things that have to be done. It occurred to me in that moment of gauze pulling that my situation is not in any way unique. It is what makes me just like you. You have lots of things you have to do, things that bring a twinge of discomfort and frustration, even outright pain, but they are what has to be done. Although I didn't articulate it this way when I first began blogging, I would say that most of my online writing is my attempt at making peace with what has to be done in my life. A big part of that writing is about my experience with disability, because it's so often difficult to experience the pity of complete strangers, and I need to discuss what it feels like. I need to tell the story of what happens when a one-legged woman walks into a university recreational facility. And no, she's treated like an invalid and not like an athlete, or is needlessly harassed by TSA employees at the airport when she tries to explain why her metal bionic leg sets off all of their sensors. One topic that I studiously avoided on my blog at first was my relationship with the church. At the time I started blogging, I was completely active in my ward, had recently served as an early morning seminary teacher, and held a stake-level calling in public affairs. When I realized that what had to be done for me was to stop attending church, I began blogging about it. The pain and isolation that I felt during those first few months of inactivity were mediated somewhat by the supportive audience of my blog readers. I felt far less alone in my faith journey. However, I've never actually been able to tell the entire story of why I left the church on my blog. I tried writing it as a series of posts and lost steam, realizing that it took too much out of me to be honest about my beliefs in such a public forum. I was ridiculed and snarked, and those of us in the blogger net will know what the snark is, right? on various blogs when I did try to discuss my faith journey, and at some point I decided it was casting pearls before swine. One of the reasons I stopped going to church was to avoid the pain of being betrayed by an institution that I'd wholeheartedly served and sacrificed for. To avoid that pain, the what-had-to-be-done decision was to stop attending the church. And discussing my reasons why with internet trolls, a few of whom seemed to be the very ward and stake members who I wanted to avoid, hardly seemed productive. Though I do chime in with my somewhat critical of the church opinions on various group LDS group blogs, and I've discussed my doings with our local Quaker meeting on my solo blog, that's about as much as I'm comfortable with discussing publicly about my leaving the church at this time. One major shift in my life after distancing from myself from the church was that I no longer had a conviction of the life of a life hereafter. Now I feel that what has to be done is to live in the moment rather than for a promise of eternal life. I feel I can't put off any of my enjoyment of my spouse or of my children to some future day of family, forever familyness. I have only today, this moment, this one precious life. My blogging is a major part of that. As I sit down and detail a small story from an overheard conversation or an interaction between family members, it is also my way of cementing my own immortality. Because I can't expect that my relationship with my children or my friends will be something that I will enjoy forever. There will come a time when they will only know me through my words and my stories. What has to be done is that I feel compelled to leave a written legacy of my life for them, so they will know that I love them forever, even after I'm dead and gone. An example of a post like this is one I'd written just after I left the church. It was following a summer of leading friends through tours of the Newport Beach Temple, which was one of my jobs as a public affairs, a state public affairs media liaison. This post is called Worship. Last night, my daughter spread her homework around on the living room floor. She sprawled her body out in the middle of textbooks, papers, pencils, pens, erasers, etc. As she tapped her toes together while doing math problems, it rivaled the most beautiful painting in the Louvre. To see her wholly absorbed in the moment as her pencil moved across the paper, to have her look up at me every once in a while and confirm a math question, to see the small ringlet curls that had escaped her ponytail and the way they framed her face. John, Game Boy, and Catgirl can always capture my complete attention. To me, they are the most disarmingly beautiful creatures. Perhaps it is sacrilege to say that I worship them, but I do. I devote most of my time in serving and loving these three people. They are my trinity. It brings to mind a quotation from Jeffrey Holland that I heard a lot this summer as I took numerous non-member friends to the Temple Open House. He said, "Heaven just wouldn't be heaven without my wife and children there." I agree with him wholeheartedly, but I can also say that for me, every day is heaven because every day I mingle with deity. So last night, as I was hobbling across the living room in frustration, trying to walk on my fake leg and my wounded leg and taking one big leap to the sofa, because I just wanted to get off both of my feet as fast as possible, my daughter came over to comfort me. She expressed her sympathy at how hard it must be for me to walk right now. I was angry and tired and hurting. I looked up at her standing over me and suggested that her life might be a whole lot better if she'd been born to a mom with two good legs. A mom who could be outside playing and running and not one who had to ask for help each time she needed to use the toilet. Catgirl, in all of her 11-year-old wisdom, said, "I only know what I have. I don't know what it's like to have a mom like that. I only know what it's like to have a mom like you, so I only want you to be my mom." I think my daughter understands a lot about what has to be done. She knows that you only know what you've experienced, and that's that. So what has to be done for her is to be gentle with her mom when she's healing, to refill my water cup and not complain as she trails alongside me through clinics and hospitals. She hears me scream and cry when I'm hurting, and she takes it in stride. I'm still learning what has to be done, and that's why I keep blogging. I've got to write to make sense of my place in this world, to understand the madness and beauty and arbitrariness of it all. And someday after I'm gone, let's say in 30 or 40 years from now, Catgirl might be facing something as painful as having to debride her own wounds. And maybe she'll look back on this blog, these thousands of words that I've written over the years, and something there will strengthen her to face the realities of her life and to do what has to be done.
handle the intricacies of the sound and microphones without horrendous feedback. Can you try to plug in the one up there for questions? Yeah.
I'll just run this back and forth.
Okay, what do we do?
The most interesting, I would say maybe startling, insighting cover I've ever seen was this last month about sharing the gospel on the internet, which I was kind of in the impression the church didn't want us to do. I guess they've kind of changed their stance on that a little bit. Right. But one of the really interesting things in that article was they mentioned that there's official people, I guess, in church headquarters who do nothing but search for articles about the church and respond to them and make corrections and things like that. I'm curious, and maybe you guys know something about this, do you think there's anybody that whose job it is to monitor kind of the blogger article in the official capacity?
I can't say for sure, but I've been told by people that there are multiple people, and I can say for sure that Times Citizens and Bicommon Consent both get multiple hits every week from internet addresses that trace back to the church office building. Of course, that could just be a bunch of readers. We get a number of hits every week from the church office building. I'm pretty sure from the former housewife does as well.
I didn't say this to bolster any Orwellian nightmares or anything, but a while before EI even started blogging, I was talking to a member of the General Relief Society presidency, and I made a joke about, oh, you guys probably have a file on me. And she said, oh, honey, we totally do. But I think that your question goes at the heart of how honest do you be. My choice is to be really honest, and we'll see what happens, but as far as I'm concerned, it's a commandment to be honest, so... but yeah, I think there are people who keep tabs. I think that would be a hideously boring, obnoxious job as well.
Two things. I get accused a lot of portraying Mormonism from a very lopsided one-sided point of view. I like to think that when I do poke fun at Mormonism a lot, but I'm poking fun at the very misunderstood and dramatic 14-year-old that I was. You know, who daydreamed of the new kids in the block and then would go repent of it at night for thinking about their voluptuous butts and not making fun of that person. So, interestingly, earlier this year, the church ran an ad campaign on their website. And like right below my picture was a picture of Jesus. And then below that was a picture of a couple of mugs that I had taken out. I'd been to Palm Springs, and I went to this really horrible tchotchke shop, and there was a mug in the shape of two exposed breasts that said, "Welcome to Palm Springs." And above it was an ad for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And all of my readers were like, "Do you know about this?" And I was like, "It is awesome." Because, I mean, I've been accused of giving, you know, this one-sided view. Well, then go click on the ad and go find out for yourself. And then the other experience was, and I'm not sure who the first counselor in the general presidency is, but apparently his son was on a plane with this person who's been reading my website for 7 years. And he got into a discussion with this guy, this reader of mine. He said, "I don't know, you know, I'm a blogger, and I actually know a Mormon blogger, and her name is Deuce." And he goes, "Oh, we're aware of her." And he wrote me this email. I was like, "Oh my God," I called him on, and I'm like, "They know about me."
I forgot to say one thing. I mean, Elder Ballard's talk was actually, the Ensign article was the kind of condensation of a talk that he gave at BYU Hawaii a few months earlier, where he explicitly cites to a blog from the blogger article. So he doesn't give the blog address, which is very disappointing, but Bookslinger, who's a LDS blogger, member of the blogger article, who gives away local Mormons and blogs about it, Elder Ballard had a link, or not a link, but a discussion of one of Bookslinger's posts and his blog about giving away local Mormons. And so it was, I mean, clearly someone, Elder Ballard himself, perhaps, or somebody who gives him material, one of his supplemental staff, reads the blogs enough to say, "You should put this in a talk," and Elder Ballard actually put it in a talk. it's one interesting thing as well as, you know, the bottleneck was much more open with names. I mean, we've got our pseudonymous names, but the flip side is the self-identified cluster of blogs and message boards, which calls itself the Disaffected Mormon Underground, or DAMU, which includes xmormon.org and others, but where the rule tends to be not name, a handle instead of some sort or other. And so I think, for whatever reason, maybe overconfidence, but in the blogging angle, there's not the perception that we will get in trouble, perhaps, for using it. And of course, our content is different on some levels, and certainly level of this amount of criticism is different on some levels. But it seems like there's a norm in the blogging angle for going by names, and there's the one person I know who has been disciplined for his blog and who was excommunicated was a DAMU participant rather than a blogger. I mean, someone who was sort of a self-identified, disaffected Mormon rather than sort of a blogger, which is kind of a self-identified, trying to find them a little way person. So that's what I know.
Talk about fear a little bit, because I am someone who blogs under a pseudonym, although, you know, loosely, because people really do know who I am. But I want to ask Janet and Kaimi, because I know that both of you still maintain your connections to the church. What would you do if you were asked not to blog again? Would you be able to just, my state president asked me when I was in Saudi Arabia to take my blog down, the one I was doing about my experiences there, and I did it. But it was a very difficult thing, and I don't know what I would have done if they asked me to take Chaim Dekolov down, because I identify with that, and it would have been just devastating to me. So I would like to know what you guys would do in that kind of situation.
For the record, I was totally obnoxious. That's a good question, and to be very honest, I can postulate about what I would do, but that's mere conjecture. I do not know what I would do if I were placed in that position. I think that if I were asked to stop blogging, first of all, I see no reason why, based on anything I blog about, anyone ever would ask me to stop blogging. But if I were asked, forgive me, oh blogger NACL members, blogging isn't as integral to my identity as writing in the print medium. If I were asked to stop blogging, I probably would. If I were asked to stop writing in any medium, I would probably wind up in a mental hospital. I don't know what I would do, but it would not be a decision I would make easily. And if I did decide to stop writing, it would erase who I am, so there'd be no point. And then if I didn't stop writing and got in big trouble, that would erase another part of who I am. I suppose, you know, talk to some members of the September 6th about that question. What do you do when you're asked to stop writing who you are? I don't know. All I can give is conjecture. I don't think I would stop writing, but I would be willing to consider taking into consideration some feelings maybe I'm missing already, how I'm affecting other people with my content. I would be open to dialogue, but flat-out censorship would probably lie me flat out.
I'm sorry, Janet, but they had to pounce on you because it sounded like fun. But I mean, they've got a couple. I mean, like Janet, I mean, my immediate answer would be a smart-ass answer, and I'd be like, well, I'll just post under a pseudonym. I'll be born in San Diego or something. But actually, I mean, if they were sort of having to. Janet's exactly right that it would pit two parts of my personality against each other and force me to, you know, fish or cut bait at that point. And I don't know. I mean, there are other outlets for ideas, but there are other outlets for, you know, spirituality as well. And I don't know how that would end up. It's something which I wouldn't like to have to deal with. Because blogging has been, for me, a very important way to discuss things and to sort of integrate my own spirituality in the church and mix them together in interesting ways that work for me.
I'll probably get this story wrong, but you can correct me, John, my husband, if you want to. You did get a letter from our bishop about your blog, and it was about a specific post that was it the Lolcats, the Mormon Lolcats that you did?
I can.
There was two posts that he'd written. Anyways, you can step up and expand on that if you want, but basically what our bishop said to John and also as well to me, because we are both online with our real names and our ward members know we're blogging and it's not kind of a secret, was if we felt so negatively about the church and if we were so willing, because we had talked about wanting to become Quakers on our blogs rather than being Mormons or having like a hybrid Mormon-Quaker identity, he suggested that we remove our names off the rolls of the church. Because that would actually put force behind our words. And, but John is going to now clarify that.
One of the things I wanted to say is if you want to get the attention of your bishop or stake president, it's not like rational critiques. It's not like... It's use swear words in conjunction with. I think I've only used like the F word like 3 or 4 times on my blog, and a couple of times it's in conjunction with. I was having a really hard day with church related issues, and that caught Bishop's attention more than any of my more atheistic arguments. And then the other thing was lolcats. Yeah, don't do the lolcats church. I did it was Joseph Smith, and he's like first vision. He's like OMG. I'm sorry. Lolcats is this phenomenon where you take a picture of a cat and then you do kind of chat speak over it. And then I saw that there weren't any religious pictures associated with like the lolcats thing, so I started doing First Vision and some other stuff. Bishop, if you don't like that. But I wanted to, while I'm up here, just one quick comment to Janet. You talked about the ripple effect, right? And I started blogging in 2001 because I felt like I was two people. There was the real me who had all of these doubts and questions and who had lost many of his beliefs. And then there was the church me who was putting on that kind of happy facade. And it was because I chose to blog under my real name that slowly over time I brought my church self into conformity with my blogging self. And it saved my sanity, I think. So.
Don't all jump up at once.
One thing I'm curious about is how have you handled criticism and hate mail? Because I'm sure, you know, I have a little rinky-dink personal blog, and I got hate mail and you know, about insisting that foul language happens at church basketball games, and someone argued with me that wasn't true ever. And then you've been attending church basketball games for 20 years, so I'm wondering how you handle the people who go full frontal attack on you for something that may be innocuous that you thought would never get that kind of reaction or response. I'm curious how you deal with that.
Maybe it's just because I've recently been through this really, really horrifying online experience where something happened at a conference a couple weeks ago, and there was a very huge misunderstanding between me and another person in front of 1,500 people. And it was solved afterwards in the hallway, and she and I had some words, and I thought everything was okay. And then I get back home, and I'm getting email after email going, "Oh my, do you have any idea what these people are saying about you?" And in 2 weeks, there have been 3 or 4 websites that have sprung up dedicated to hating me, and dedicated to hating my husband, and dedicated to hating my dogs, and dedicated to making fun of my children. And every possible horrible thing you can say about a human being has been said about me. And I'm a big believer in therapy. marital and personal, and a lot of it is just getting up and walking away from the computer and finding joy outside of my online self and outside of my online life. About once every 3 months, I take the best hate mail and I put it into a hate mail post where I make fun of the insanity. And those are always the most popular posts. But mostly a lot of it is realizing that these people have their own problems, and it's their own insecurities, and it's their own boogeymen that they are projecting onto you. And as hard as it is to just get over the fact that someone just called me a manipulative bitch, who abuses my power, who should have her child taken away from her because I treat her M&Ms occasionally. As hard as it is to not take that personally, it is someone else's issue, and it has nothing to do with me, and that's how I have to deal with it.
This is fascinating because this is a known issue, right? Because if we're in a conversation just in person, and you know, and I really don't like Janet, and I'm saying mean and nasty things about her, she's just going to glare at me. I mean, I get all this feedback directly from her, and I'm going to start to, you know, if I have a conversation with Janet and all of her friends, they're all going to start glaring at me. I'm going to feel like, wow, this is a conversation I'm going to walk away. I mean, you can give this kind of feedback, so we don't do these things in person. You don't walk up to somebody in person and say you are evil, bad, you know, person. You don't do that. But online, we're separated from these sorts of negative social peer feedback. And so, in fact, we may be parts of other communities where it looks good, and I can go tell all my friends, ha ha ha, I just made fun of Jenna Remy and her blog, isn't that great? And so I not only don't get the negative feedback, but I may get this perverse positive feedback from really wacky sociopathic people. I mean, if you haven't read the New York Times article from last Sunday about these trolling communities who literally have contests to see how many people they can hurt and what sort of pain they can inflict on other people online. I mean, there's really negative elements out there. You have to realize that normal feedback doesn't work, and saying, you really hurt me, which you can do in person, doesn't work when these people are not taking those normal social cues, and the best you can do is just ignore it at that point. There's nothing else you can do. Any reaction that you give them will just make them happy.
Although sometimes if you're really nice to them, it pisses them off. See, everyone thinks I'm nice just because I'm nice, but there's a black underbelly to that. And honestly, that's how I tend to deal with it. I either assume they've got their own issues, or I'm kind of passive-aggressively very nice and logical back, and they get increasingly more pissed off, and then they just kind of spontaneously combust and go away.
This is very THX theater preview, boomy. Your head is exploding, THX. Sorry, I just want to say this. So, as a family member who watches someone who blogs, I mean, I have my own thing, whatever. But as a family member who watches someone put themselves online, one of the things that I saw in the past, and I've seen this before, but really in fine point of this past week, has been that people create their own version of reality online. That I can be with Heather in a public place interacting with people, and those people will take that experience back to their blog and write about it, and it's nothing close to what happened. But the amount of projection and the amount of sort of wearing an issue on your outer body part is really staggering. And I don't know that we have the tools yet to cope with that. That before, you know, it's Charles Foster Kane and Hearst Corporation, whatever, there was sort of big targets. And you could go after him, you know, lawyers and whatever. But now, all that is shrunk down to an almost individual level where anybody can walk out of this room right now and go write complete untruths about what was said here today. And people who weren't there have no idea that that's not true. They have no way of determining the truth. they have no way to determine reality. And that, I think, is really frightening. But also interesting, because it kind of means we need to talk about things a lot. And anyway, I just wanted to say that as a family member who was part of this, I was going to ask the others if your family members pay a price, and if they're entirely comfortable with your... I mean, I've made peace with things years ago, I'm fine, but I'm just curious if that's been an issue for anybody up here. So, you don't have to answer this, Heather.
I've made peace because my blog pays for your computers.
Well, I don't... Like, maybe one of the challenges I have, because I tell stories about my kids sometimes, is now my daughter will step in and correct me and say, actually, that's not what happened, Mom. This is what they really said. Because I always sort of make interesting when I tell my stories in my blog. So I'm being humbled by that. Yeah, when the kids start reading the blog and responding, that kind of had to make me more honest. But with my challenge is actually that my extended family reads my blog, but they won't... I don't know what it is. I have this very weird family that we don't talk, but we do talk, whatever. And it causes all kinds of problems. I can't mention my family members on my blog. I can't mention their names. I can't mention my mother, like even as my mother in her role as my mother. I can't say things like that because it causes so much tension within my family. And it's really frustrating because there's a lot of amazing, beautiful things that I would like to talk about, stories I'd like to talk about, my extended family on my blog that I can't do out of respect for them because of the way that it would damage our relationships. But they read my blog, I think, voraciously because they're like, that's how they find out what's going on in my life and it's entertaining and everything else. So it's a kind of ironic tension with my family, I guess.
My husband was very, very introverted and he sort of knew what he was getting for when he married a very extroverted girl to be in with. But I'd say, yeah, he's paid something of a price. He's long expressed his desire to me to be a stealth Mormon, and I have erased that possibility from his existence. But, and this is not a slam on my husband, rather a recognition of the culture, both American and Mormon, in which he was raised. He finds it, I think, somewhat challenging that he's often, despite his two doctorates and the fact that he's a doctor and blah, 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 he doesn't really like being defined by his relationship to me. Oh, look, you're Mr. Bannon. To which, you know, all I can really respond is, I'm sorry, and welcome to the world the women live in. But it's how I handle that is, you know, he is an introvert. He has a right to be an introvert. I don't have a right to violate his stories that are his to tell. I don't tell. I have no business doing that. Even if we are one flesh, that's not my role. So he respects my right to speak, and I respect his right to stay silent. And our kid, our kid... We got baby gifts from people we've never met. So that was awesome.
This has been wonderful. I want to thank all of you. And this recent question about how your family pays the price for this. I came to blogging the old-fashioned way. I came to blogging because I realized that if Montaigne, father of the essay, were alive today, he would be a blogger. And I started doing it because I'm interested in personal essay, autobiography, and so forth. And Joan Didion has written about, you know, what it cost her family for her to write about them in print. Heather, I am so thrilled that there is a book of yours available that we can buy paper, because what do we need with all those trees? And I am curious, you mentioned, Janet, about how you distinguish between blogging and writing. I want to know how blogging contributes to writing, if you distinguish between online writing and print page writing, if others of you have aspirations for books, what your future is, Heather, for more books, anything to do with more traditional print paper stuff.
I have a book out right now that it's a collection of essays, and there's about 15 bloggers that I contacted and had them write essays about fatherhood, and it's just a collection. It is not the book that I wished had been my first book, but there's all these illegal things that I can't talk about. won't go into. But the book that I love and adore and will be touring for comes out next April, and it's called It Sucked and Then I Cried. It's a memoir of pregnancy and postpartum depression. And I will never write a book again. I will never, ever, 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 ever write a book again. It was like extracting all my internal organs out the top of my head. He wanted to kill me, and I wanted to kill him, and I wanted to like jab forks into my leg. I hated it so much. And I maybe it's just because I think I've been blogging for so long that it fits the way I write. It fits. I'm kind of like a sprinter when it comes to writing. I'm not a marathon runner. And I really enjoy the small bits of pieces that I write. So my mom and everybody else in John's family was like, don't ever say never. But no, I will never write a book again. It's awful.
One thing I didn't mention earlier was sort of the intersection between my academic life and my blogging life. And just because what I was talking about was way too long anyways as it was, but I actually didn't tell, I'm a graduate student in a PhD program, and I didn't tell anyone in my department at all. No one knew I had a blog until just a few months ago. I was sitting in a classroom, and a professor asked me if I was a blogger, because I was talking about some academic historian bloggers, and I admitted I was, and he asked me for my URL, and I was kind of freaked out, because it was a pilgrim girl, and I'm like, old lady, and I'm very, I felt like very stupid about it. So anyways, long story short, not too long after that, I ended up sharing with him some of my writing and some of the things I wanted to do with that writing, and I wrote a little piece for him about how I felt blogging was actually an asset to my academic writing, because it helped me sort of push the boundaries of what was writing for the academy, and how I was going to apply that in my dissertation and whatever. And I ended up getting a very prestigious grant for doing that piece, because he felt like that was so, I mean, I think he saw this professor I was working with could really see that blogging is the future of writing in a lot of ways, and people who are pushing those boundaries are, at least this is what I'm telling myself now, saying I'm so awesome, excited, writing, first of all, anyways. So it was really exciting to get that. I felt validating, because of course, blogging, it doesn't pay anything, Heather. But I mean, at least like the little small blog that I've kept all this time, that's I think it's had a benefit in that way. And whether or not, I don't think I'll really test bits in my dissertation on my blog, that's not really what I intend to do, but I think all of the writing that I do is kind of sparks my creativity, loosens my writing muscles, and helps me to be a better academic writer. So it will be print someday, but kind of in a sort of funky way. Does that make sense, Holly? Okay.
Just to piggyback a little bit off Jenna, this comes up a whole lot in my job too. I mean, people talk about it in academia. You know, I write on a law blog as well as Mormon-themed blogs, and so if I'm discussing legal matters, should that be something that should be considered, because you have to talk to the dean about, you know, articles you've published and service you've done, you know, conferences you've spoken at, and I think there's a mixed verdict right now, and it sort of depends on the person and how much they want to give that credit, and I think a lot of academics don't, but some do, and some blog posts become articles. I haven't had it on the legal end yet, mostly because my legal blogging is something I use to focus on areas that I don't want to write articles about, and so they end up being non-article-ish posts. But, I mean, you can ask Marianne, a post that I posted on By Common Consent a few months ago is now in Sunstone as a letter to the editor. Dan emailed me and said, we like this post, but, you know, would you consider writing it up and changing it a little bit and making it more of a letter to the editor format? And it's that, and Nate Ullman has done the same thing. Several people have, and, you know, not that it's, you know, the big, you know, huge New York Times bestseller list or, you know, massive book publishing or anything, but many people have entered into the Mormon Studies publication world through blog posts, and so you get into Sunstone through blog posts. It's not unusual, and that's kind of a fun mix for me. I don't know if I'll ever have a blog post or blog set of posts turn into a book, but I mean, write a law book at some point, but it probably won't really be based on my blogging, because I try to segregate those out, because for various professionals say, like, don't want to blog about them writing articles about, because then somebody else might beat you to it, and then you've got preempted, and then you've got to explain to the law review editor why you're writing about something somebody else just wrote about. So I don't blog about what I'm writing about professionally.
Your question, Molly, I think is particularly poignant for those of us who want to make careers in the academy, because the academy is not a monolith. There's so many competing voices, particularly rallying around the field of autobiography, which is also women's autobiography is my field. And I have, even though I am not particularly good at coding or anything computer-like, I've been on committees and gone to conferences on technology, and there's a great deal of textual and oral violence exerted towards the old standards of the academy and lengthy texts and footnotes, and you get, it's a culture war within the academy, as you know. As far as my personal place in it right now, I thought it would be just really cool to use bits of blogging and journal as stitches, sutures that show in my autobiography, which is about non-traditional means of female autobiography, and my dissertation director, and I have a whole section, it's all framed with the idea of a quilt, which is quite the feminist cliche at this point, but my dissertation director told me that was all very lovely, but if I wanted to get, you know, a job, I should stop that, because it blogs. Blog entries are short, and they don't require discipline and attention, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So part of me agrees with him. It's, I can write a blog entry, and usually do, in about 5 minutes. My chapters for my dissertation take, sadly, longer than that, which is why I have blog posts written and a dissertation that isn't finished. But I don't know how to answer your question other than to say there's lots of intersections and there are points of violence within the academy itself. I'm not completely comfortable with the idea that writing is going entirely the way of the blog, because I do think blog posts are incomplete and too short generally. Physiologically, you can't read something too lengthy on the computer with all the flickers. It's very hard on your brain. So I like the print medium. I'm a Luddite. But, you know, the intersection, those nodal points, are going to see increasing fire within our professions, and I don't know where that's going to go. I hope I get a grant.
We are at the end of our time, so let's thank the panelists again for sharing a little bit more about